Welcome to another episode of Business Beyond Borders. Today, I'm really excited to have with us David In, who is currently a partner at GSR Ventures. Welcome, David, to today's episode.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And maybe we'll start off with you giving a quick introduction of what you're up to now. What does your role at GSR Ventures look like?
Yeah, sounds good. So first of all, my name is David. I'm Singaporean, but I've lived in many different countries. So right now, I'm spending a lot of time between the US and Southeast Asia. I'm a partner at GSR Ventures, which is a early stage venture capital firm with around 4 billion assets under management. So I invest in companies across both regions, but also selectively in companies in other parts of the world, such as the UK and Brazil as well. So as an early stage fund, we've invested across most verticals. Mm-hmm. For me, I've also looked at many different verticals, such as EV motorbikes in Vietnam, HRSS software in the Philippines, and so on. But primarily, given my previous experiences, I focus very much on the fintech and Web3.
Nice. And with the focus on, global kind of Web3 and fintech sector, how do you personally see the transformational potential of the journey in these industries? And specifically, maybe quite recently, what opportunities have really excited you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, first of all, I just see so much potential. And one proxy I look into is I look into the underlying industry. So if you look at financial services as a sector, this is one of the largest, fastest growing, and yet still highly profitable businesses. Look at the banks, look at the biggest stocks, in Singapore, in around the region, in many countries around the world. It's always the banks, right? And the reason is because they're making a lot of profits, and there's a lot of revenue pool and profit pool. And I think with the power of technology, you can basically both work with existing incumbents, but also sometimes help to create new businesses. And this is across so many different areas. I could go into them, but I'll say that two primary areas I look into are in the payments and credit space.
Okay.
So in the payment space, for example, this could include domestic payments. Mm-hmm. For example, Stripe, they processed just between Black Friday and Cyber Monday, they processed close to $20 billion in payment volumes. And in terms of revenue, just within these few days, made almost $500 million in revenues. That shows the extent of the amount of payments that happens. Yeah. And we ourselves actually invested in a Singapore-based fintech called Niam that has gone beyond Singapore globally. And it's doing extremely well as well. So I think within payments, there's so much that can be done. Mm-hmm. I think on the lending space, there's a lot that can be done as well. I can highlight, we invest in another Singapore-based company called Atome that started locally but has gone to different markets. Mm-hmm. Also invested in a company in the UK called FinTurn. So it's also in the lending space. But what's interesting about them is that they're applying AI to open banking data.
Yeah.
And therefore, they're able to really underwrite customers who are hugely underserved and not able to get a proper loan right now, and they're able to serve these segments. So I think whether it's payments, lending, and obviously you have other sectors like insurance, investments, and so on, I think there's a lot that technology can do to improve financial services.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And also because you are looking at, the fintech industry across different regions, right? Maybe it would be helpful for you to share a little bit about the parallels and also contrast that you have seen across, the fintech ecosystem across different markets. Especially, I think previously you had, you started out your career and at McKinsey early on, where you helped to launch new ventures and service lines, and then have been looking at this industry from both an operator angle as well as from now an investment angle.
Yeah. So first of all, I think there's so much we can learn globally and across borders. Mm-hmm. And there's just so much arbitrage that you can do. And within financial services, I think what's particularly interesting is that a lot of financial services and a lot of money is digitized already.
Yeah.
So it's very ripe for disruption versus there are some industries, for example, like construction, there's only so much the technology can play a part in it, right? Like it's still hard to get robots to build a building from scratch and all that. So financial services, I think it's very ripe for disruption. And sure, there might be some differences in local regulation, licensing, and so on. But but there's a lot of lessons across borders. Like for us, you know, part of the reason why we invested in Atome is that we saw how the buy now, pay later model worked, for example, in the US with a firm.
Right.
So we thought, you know, hey, this is something that could potentially work in the region. Obviously, you have to localize it. You know, you can't just copy and paste, but you get inspired by models elsewhere.
Yeah.
Another example, we also invested in a company in Africa, probably the largest fintech there called OPay.
Okay.
And a big part of it was that we're inspired by what happened in China with Alipay and WeChat Pay. And we saw that in emerging markets, you have a lot of similar needs. And
right.
So we invested in a team that we thought was best able to apply a lot of these learnings over.
Very nice. Yeah. And do the kind of banking needs sort of differ between more mature markets like the US compared to, you know, Southeast Asia, which is a bit more emerging as a market?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think if we really have to draw a dichotomy, I think the developed markets definitely resemble each other a little more. There's some markets where the traditional financial system, to be fair, it's not perfect, but it's relatively developed.
Mm-hmm.
Right? A huge part of the population, they already have access to bank accounts, for example.
Yep.
And it's all about, you know, how do you add on new banking or financial services features.
Correct.
Versus I think in developing countries, or emerging markets, there's a lot more, there's a lot less incumbents in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like the existing infra isn't as developed, which means that a lot of times you might also have leapfrog opportunities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like everyone knows that in China, but also in many parts of the world, people went straight into QR payments instead of credit cards. So there is some differences there.
Mm. And as you look at investments across different countries, are there different lens that you might apply as you consider investment opportunities?
Yeah, definitely. I think as an investor, we look at a couple of areas. One is we definitely look at the overall market, a lot of the macro conditions. What's the size of the overall market?
Yep.
What's the GDP of the people? What's the underlying growth of the market? What's the level of digitization? I think those all affect the opportunities. And specifically, for example, it affects the size of the opportunities. If you're looking at a huge market, you could just capture even a niche area to begin with, for example, like the US or China, and you can still grow to become very big from there. But if you look at a pretty small market like Singapore, then it's very hard to, for example, build a niche player and grow that to become really big.
Yep. Makes sense. Now I want to kind of turn back the time to when you went to school. You're the first Singaporean to have graduated from Yale, Harvard, and Stanford. And at the same time, you left Singapore at a pretty young age. Have your career across, you know, many countries at MIT, being at as an MIT researcher in Cambridge, and then also moving on to investment banking in China, and then in the US, and then launching ventures with McKinsey, as we had spoken about a bit earlier. And then also running own startups around the region. I think my question was, maybe could you maybe give us a walkthrough of your journey across these different countries and how those experiences and perspectives have shaped the way that maybe now you invest and also the way you look at the world?
Yeah, no, thanks for pointing those out. definitely racked up my airline miles and student debt. But overall, I'm very grateful, right? In some ways, sometimes I look at my peers or my friends, they seem to have taken a slightly more linear path and done very well for themselves. And I'm very happy for them. But for myself, I'm also very happy with the path I've taken. I think some of the underlying motivations was I was definitely very curious, right? Singapore is a great place to live and all that, but I've always been curious about the world outside. I could have gone into, actually after JC, I applied to medical school at NUS, law school at SMU and all that. And I could have gone on a more professional path.
Yeah.
I also really enjoyed the path I took where I pursued a liberal arts education. I got to learn areas that I never thought I would, you know, areas like psychology, areas like political science that I would say maybe are not directly impactful to my career. But I do feel like if you connect the dots, they're still very influential and additive to the work that I do today. For example, like political science, and I went to the government school as well. Like today, like if you try to understand business, You have to understand, you know, where the geopolitical tensions are going.
Yep.
You have to understand where national policies are going,
mm-hmm.
right? So having an understanding of some of the policies and political science frameworks, I think can be very helpful.
Yep.
And for psychology, again, it might not seem directly useful, but so much of what we do today is about, at the end of the day, we're working with humans, we're dealing with humans, understanding how humans work.
Mm-hmm.
And more specifically, I think to investments, a lot of it is understanding how the other party thinks, right? What are some psychological biases or tendencies that they might have? So I think having that framework of psychology helps a lot as well. So I think a lot of these learnings, you know, looking when I was making them, I think a lot of what was driving me was just around curiosity.
Right.
But I think looking back, I think a lot of these have come together to help me in my current career.
And maybe kind of would be helpful for you to also share with us, what was your mindset like as you decide to move from country to country, region to region? How is that experience like, you know, building the network and your career from scratch in a new country, a new city?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, first of all, it was a lot of curiosity, right? Like, I was just doing it because I thought it was fun. You know, I love living in new places, experiencing new cultures, getting to know new people, and, you know, sometimes picking up a new language. So I think it's just fun in itself. But I think there's also an angle where I think pretty early on in my life, I saw that, you know, we live in a very globalized world. As much as I love Singapore, I think Singapore is just, you know, one part of the world. And I think even to be a better Singaporean and to better contribute to Singapore, I think it's important to know, you know, who our neighbors are, who our biggest trading partners are, and to be that bridge to help to increase all that. I mean, there's a lot of stats around it, right? I think Singapore has more tourists than its population, right? Tourist visits. I think our trade, our international trade is 3 times our GDP. So it's impossible for us to live within just within our own corners and, you know, ignore what's happening around the world. So, and I think ultimately it's been very fulfilling as well, you know, being able to go abroad, try out different things. I think the good thing is that, first of all, coming from Singapore, Singapore comes with a very strong brand equity. I think people generally think that, you know, we are like, you know, rule abiding, smart, hardworking, honest people. So it's also easy for us to go abroad. I think obviously having a passport, I think, is it the most or second most powerful in the world, allows us to travel as well, to go to different places without a visa. And finally, I think we're also blessed. You know, when I was growing up, learning a second language, a third language, I didn't, and even growing up in a very multicultural society, I didn't realize that it's going to be so helpful. But now, as I go to foreign places and I have to pick up new language and I have to work with people of different backgrounds and different religions and different cultures and different races. I think coming from Singapore, we have a particular edge.
And I think, you know, your curiosity also extends to in school where you started China Hands, which was a leading kind of student-led platform, which offers a unique perspective on US-China relations. And then that kind of also transcended into how your career panned out eventually. What made you decide to start this platform?
I think part of it was when I was in school at Yale. I think this is very core to the US culture as well. A lot of times you just have to be a self-starter. And a lot of times if something does not exist, you don't always have to change it. But, you know, don't have fear, right? Just go create it. I think a couple of things I felt. One was a lot of things in life, you know, whether it's taking an experiment, making a change, and so on. I think the risk isn't that high. And for example, it's the same for starting a magazine. What I thought back then, again, was I was curious about this. I couldn't find any platform that fulfilled my interest. And I feel like everyone around me was interested in this space. For example, Chinese was the most popular foreign language at Yale at that time. And yet, you know, there was nothing that was talking about China and US-China relations. And obviously, as we know, this has developed into the most important bilateral relationship in the world. So I just thought, you know, hey, I'm curious about it. I believe in the mission. Why not do something about it? And at the very worst, you know, if everything fails, right, I still gain some experience in terms of how to build something, in terms of the recruiter team, and so on. So it was honestly not too much of a risk. It was just why not kind of decision.
And you know, building on that, right now there has been a lot of talk around the U.S.-China relations, and my next question is around how do you see this evolving dynamics between these two superpowers? What's your firsthand view regarding this, and how do you think this has affected or impacted or will impact the global tech and startup scene going forward?
Yeah, I think the geopolitical tensions are here to stay. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to disappear anytime. At the same time, I'm hopeful, and I think a lot of the leadership, you know, of these major countries, including, you know, Singapore's own leaders.
Yeah.
I think no one wants, you know, a hot war, a major conflict. But there is going to be a lot of tension. There's going to be a lot of competition, and I think how it spills over into the world. I think first of all, we're gonna have a lot of competition over tech itself.
Mm.
As we saw, I think there's been a lot of restrictions placed on both sides regarding, you know, the investments in tech companies and so on. I think some of these are here to stay. I think and some of them will accelerate. But at the same time, I think it creates opportunities as well.
Yeah.
Like look at Singapore. So many companies are based out of Singapore today, both American and Chinese companies.
Yeah,
because Singapore is seen as a neutral place. So I think there are opportunities that comes with that as well. I think at the end of the day, there's still so much you know, synergies between the US and China, and both their economies. This is not like the Cold War where the two economies of the US and USSR were pretty much out of whack from each other, out of sync. I think the Chinese and the US economy, I think they're very interlinked. And I think there's still going to be a lot of trade and all that that's going on. Sometimes, you know, it goes through a middle country. And we just have to adjust to the changing paradigms and find new opportunities.
Yeah. Makes sense. And also, you know, you have been since you have started writing for China Hands, and then now you have also been contributing articles to in the Forbes, and then writing on a various different topics, and you know, from like talking about the Israeli startup ecosystem, and then also covering things like Crazy Rich Asians brand strategy. How does this media experience or writing experience continue to complement what you're doing right now? Was it also piqued by curiosity that you got into this, and what does it look like next for you?
Yeah, no, I think going back to the it doesn't seem that related when I was doing it, but looking back, I think the dots really connect.
Right.
And overall, I'm and even like we're doing a podcast today, I guess this is a form of media and journalism as well. I think I found a lot of journalists have applied their skill sets to other areas.
Yeah.
Like one of the most famous venture capitalists of all time, Mike Moritz, who led Sequoia for many decades. He actually started his career as a reporter at Time Magazine. And he was noticed because he was writing really interesting and insightful articles about tech companies such as Apple. So that's how he ended up at Sequoia. I think in terms of very tangible ways in which it affects my life today, I think first of all, looking for a good investment and putting together investment memo, I think it is very similar to looking for a good story and putting together an article. At the end of the day, when I was writing articles, I was able to put myself in the shoes of my readers, and I always think about, you know, am I adding something new? Does this story make sense? Is this the right way to frame it? And I think now when I'm writing an investment memo, it's very similar as well. How you communicate, how you put things together, how you connect the dots, I think it's hugely important.
Yeah.
I think number two, I think journalism and working on media has also helped me learn to gather a lot of data. And be very creative and resourceful about it, and ultimately connect the dots between the data.
Yeah.
And it's similarly true for investment as well. I think ultimately for investment, obviously there's the judgment part of it, but the other part of it is even getting information and hopefully getting some asymmetric information edge. And I think what I learned as a journalist, which is just being very resourceful about finding new data points, finding proxy of data points, trying to be creative about that, I think has helped a lot. And I think finally, a lot of media and for investing is also around working with people.
Yeah.
Like when I was a journalist, I remember like I was, you know, in my early 20s and, you know, whether it's in interviewing people or finding people to talk to, very much putting myself out there to leverage other people and to work with them and to talk to them. And I think it's very similar in investments as well, whether it's talking to other investors, talking to founders, talking to people in the ecosystem. It's very much about working with people and talking to people.
Yeah. And that's very interesting because you, I start to see a lot of parallels in both the roles that you have mentioned. And what I'm curious about is how do you kind of keep abreast of different news around different regions and countries, and how do you decide what inspire you to write or pick the next story?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think in terms of what I read, I think it is about finding sources that I think interest you, that I think gives you the right amount of information and so on. So I do subscribe to quite a few newsletters that I read a lot. I think, for example, over other platforms like LinkedIn and Twitter, I think they've started to learn about the people that I like to read, the kind of articles I like to engage with. So I think they tend to push me relatively good articles. And same for my phone. Like I use a Chrome browser and they recommend some articles, right? I think they do a pretty good job. Maybe like 1 out of 5 articles that they recommend, I'll read it. So I think that's part of it. And also I think at the end of the day, we're all very busy people, right? I think it's also finding ways to maybe multitask whenever possible. And also finding a portfolio of things to get more information from. So on the multitasking point, what I do is that I really like podcasts. I think especially for longer form stuff. So, you know, I just listened to a 3-hour podcast on Visa yesterday on this acquired podcast. Yep. So what I was doing was that I think I was traveling somewhere. So I just listened to it on the way there. And I think I listened to it when I was like cleaning up the house. And sometimes when I go to the gym and I'm on the bike in the gym, you know, I can also like read some articles as well. So that's kind of on the multitasking point. I think on the other point of also having a portfolio, what I sometimes do is also like, I think it's easy for us, you know, if you like a topic, you know, you just keep reading stuff that, you know, seems like you're being very productive, but ultimately, you know, you're just reading the same thing from different angle. So I try to make sure that I'm also like getting information and reading articles and podcasts from more diverse voices to actively force myself to be exposed to new viewpoints, to learn something new versus just, you know, understanding one space really well. And as mentioned, like so many things are interconnected. Like even if I'm looking at fintech stuff, maybe looking at a different sector, it helps me understand the trends in that industry that might potentially be related to or at least relevant to what's happening in the fintech space.
Yeah. And which topics would be of current interest to you right now?
Right now, there's quite a few. Like one, obviously people are talking about Charlie Munger. He's always been someone I respected. So just rereading some of his best works and mentioning interesting quotes has been interesting. I think also following a lot of things in AI.
Okay.
Like there's just so much that's happening in AI. Like for example, yesterday there's a company that has been around for a while, but yesterday they came up with a big PR push called Pika Lab. And you know, they're just able to generate incredible AI videos.
It's
pretty amazing what they can do. So I think just reading about, you know, many different things, right? Also reading a lot about the macro economy and geopolitics. I think those are actually quite relevant to where the world is moving and to a lot of our work, even if it doesn't seem so direct.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And also because like it's important to keep in touch with things that are at a macro level, and then you can see how that trickles down into the day-to-day things that you do, not just from a portfolio management perspective, but also in terms of investment choices and where we put our money in. And kind of diving a bit more into the startup space, which you have spent quite a bit of time in, what are some of the key takeaways you have for founders who are looking to expand to different countries and regions, especially since you have been looking at pretty global startups so far?
I think international expansion is not easy, but I do think it pays a lot of dividends, especially if you're also from a smaller market like Singapore.
Yeah.
I think you have to, if you want to build something big, you have to go to different markets.
Yeah.
If you're in a market like the US where it's huge, you can spend a lot of time in the US. But at some point, if you become super big, you have to go abroad as well.
Yeah.
I think some learnings or observations I've made. I think first of all, a lot of times, as the, let's say if you're a founder, the culture and all that starts from you.
Right.
And I think if you want to be global, you want to build a global team, you want to build a global organization that's competitive globally, I think you have to start from yourself. I think very often firms that talk about being global, but starting from the top, they're not very global. I think it's very hard to make it happen because it's always going to be an afterthought. It's always going to be a lower priority. But I think for yourself, you need to be able to be global to attract global talent and so on. I think number two, it's also about, I think, both leveraging some of these global learnings and cross-border learnings, but also learning how to localize effectively.
Yeah.
I think most business models that try to just copy and paste haven't worked out very well. But I think you have to spend some time, feeling the ground, smelling the air, living like a local. So I, to give an example, I was talking to the founder of C Group a couple of years ago before they really expanded in LATAM. And what he said was, he literally brought the whole management team over to LATAM for 2 weeks before they decided to invest big time there. And for 2 weeks, they just lived like locals.
Right.
They just try to understand really how everything works. Because at high level, maybe emerging markets are similar, but still people are very different. And even within LATAM, when I was there, like Mexico is very different from Brazil, which is very different from Argentina or Peru. And just like, people come to Southeast Asia, think it's a whole monolithic region. We all know that Indonesia is very different from Singapore and very different from Philippines or Vietnam. So I think really knowing how to localize, I think it's important as well.
Yeah. And what I really like was that he didn't just bring, as in live there himself, but he also brought the entire management team so that everyone can collectively agree and share their perspectives on the market and really truly understand what it's like to expand into LATAM for at least 2 weeks, and then of course longer beyond that. And I, one of the interesting things that you have mentioned is how founders can need to start thinking global, and that needs to start from the top. What in your view makes a global founder, or how can they do more of that?
How to be more of a global founder? I would say that frankly, now the world has made it much easier to be a global founder as well, compared to even, I think, 5 years ago. I think there's so many translation software. I think for better or for worse, COVID has made remote work a lot more commonplace. There's a lot of cross-border hiring platforms such as Deel and Multiplier that have come up. So it's a lot easier and to take care of like payments, compliance, and even talent aggregation. I think it's a lot easier compared to before, to be frank. But what does it take to be global? I think it's still back to mindset, because there's a lot of maybe harder skill sets that you can pick up. Right? Like, sure, it's impossible to know every language well. But what you realize is that a lot of leaders, it's not really about how fluent you are per se in a foreign language. I think it's due back to things like charisma, conviction, and so on. Look at someone like Jack Ma. Right? He doesn't speak perfect English, but people around the world, I remember, I knew founders from Southeast Asia, from LATAM, from Africa a few years ago who were saying that, hey, I want to be the Jack Ma of my country. Right?
Because
he was he was inspiring speaking, you know, when he was spoken in a different language. So I think a lot of these harder skills, I think, not harder skills, I would say like maybe more technical or linguistic skills. I think having some baseline, like English is definitely the most common global language. I think it's useful. But I think it really still comes down to a global mindset, knowing that you want to be global, knowing that you want to have a global team, knowing that you want to operate globally. I think some of those are more important than other stuff that's a bit more superficial.
Makes sense. Okay, and just to wrap up the English segment for today's podcast, based on all the experiences that you've shared and all the experiences that you've personally experienced, what does the next 5 years look like for you?
The question I do think about at the end of the day, I think it was Eisenhower who had a quote which says that plans are useless, but planning is everything. So I'm very aware that in the next 5 years, whatever I'm planning today, it's probably not going to happen the way I'd expect I plan for it to be. But I think at a high level, what I'm looking for, I think I'm going to continue what I'm doing in investment. I think especially for early stage investment, it's also a very long-term career. Like, I might invest in a company today, and 5 years later, maybe it's just starting to blossom and grow. So it does take time for companies to mature and grow into truly big companies, if not unicorn companies as well. So I think 5 years from now, I'll still be doing the same job, helping some of my co current companies grow into hopefully large generational companies, but also applying some of the new learnings I have, to then invest in new companies. And I think on the personal front, I think it's still keeping myself active outside of work, trying to spend time with family, trying to be continue to be curious about the world. Just like I think Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, even I think their very old days, they're like still reading as much as they can, right? Because it's good to stay curious, to keep your mind active, and to just learn. I think learning is a privilege. And then as part of that, I think another part of it is just keeping our body and our mind healthy, because I feel like now there's more awareness about keeping fit and mental health. But still, I think unless we actively set aside time, it's easy to forget about those and deprioritize them.
And really commit yourself to that.
Exactly. Yeah, build them into habits.
Okay, with that, we wrap up the English segment of today's episode, and now we move on to the Chinese rapid fire questions. Now, 现在我们进行快问快答的环节。那David，你准备好了吗？
好呀，好呀，期待。
那首先就是想要您介绍一下，用中文介绍一下自己吧。
好，对，大家好，我叫 David，我是新加坡人，然后过去几年都是在中国、在美国和东南亚各地工作，然后我现在是一个投资人，在经沙江创投，然后主要投特别早期的科技公司。然后也很幸运能够跟一些很棒的创业家一起合作，帮他们建立他们的公司。
对，就是之前在英文的播客当中，你说了，就是curiosity 是一个，就是一个一直激发你的一个怎么讲 one area，然后就是你希望，就是现在你希望学习或提高的一个领域会是哪一方面呢？
我觉得工作方面肯定想提高的就是对于 AI 的理解，就是所谓的人工智能。我觉得现在这个领域，我觉得就是每天发展的特别多，然后我觉得它真的会颠覆每个行业。我觉得在各国各地都会看得到，所以我觉得真的就是想去多了解 AI 到底是怎么样的一种科技。然后未来给我们带来的一些影响会是怎么样的？然后我觉得除此以外，就是也是有一些业余的一些学习方面学习想学习的东西。比如说我现在也在我特别喜欢吃东西，所以我也有时候喜欢去烧烧饭，所以我经常去超市上烧一些不同的一些饭菜，所以那个可以算是生活上的一些学习。
是啊，挺有趣的。那你在 AI 就是学习方面，你是怎么样去就是更加提高自己的知识呢？就是是读书吗？还是刚才你所说的，就是你也挺喜欢看播客、听播客？对，
对，我觉得学习肯定是要通过各种方式，一个是各种渠道，和个人也要通过不同的方式嘛。因为比如说古希腊人他们有句话说，你要学的话，你第一你要去读，第二你要去说，然后第三你要去教。所以我觉得对我来说学习也一样，比如说读的方面，不管是比如说听一些 podcast 啊，或者是在 Twitter 上面啊，我自己去尝试，比如说我自己会去 Discord 里面看大家是怎么生成一些新的图像啊，或者是自己去尝试一些新的 AI 工具。然后我觉得另外一部分就是书，找一些志同道合，然后我觉得比较有想法的一些同学，而且大家不一定需要想法一致，但反正大家可以比较开放性的去讨论。然后第三，我觉得某程度上也是去教吧。当然，教的话也我也不是很高人，但很多时候就是至少能做一个分享啊。像我们之前提到为什么去写作，或者为什么会去做一些博客啊等等的。我觉得很多时候不能说教，但很多时候就像巴菲特自己说，他每次写他的每年的年报的时候，他说不是为了他的投资者，是为了他自己。因为你能够把你很多思路和很多想法写下来，然后从中你其实也学到一些新的东西。
那在你就是你的职业生涯当中，您有没有曾经遇到过一个非常重要，或者是一个对你本身就是觉得很有影响力的一个导师呢？
我觉得导师肯定有很多，而且现在每天也是多亏有很多导师，包括我在我的公司也是因为我觉得我的老板是我的导师，我才去那里工作。但可能讲一个让我特别有启发的一个人，我觉得还是新加坡第一位总理李光耀先生。我觉得就第一，每天我体会的，比如说新加坡的很多福利、新加坡的设施、新加坡的特征，我觉得也都是因为先人当时做出的一些不光是牺牲和当时比较鲜明的一些见解吧。然后我虽然现在是做科技投资但我最喜欢的就是跟创业家合作。然后我觉得某程度上，我觉得李光耀也是一个特别有创业精神的一个人。然
是啊，
后新加坡就像他当时做的一个创业项目，所以我也是特别敬佩。他当时能有这种创业精神，把一个国家建立起来。
对，是很敬佩，也是今年是李光耀他的100年的一个生计，所以就也很 timely，
是
对。
的。
那之前刚才你所说的，就是你现在也是专注于在 Web 3还有那个金融科技这两道领域，就去更详细的投资，也是因为就是之前的工作经验也是专注于这些领域嘛。那就是向前看的话，你认为在这两道板块的当中，最大的机遇会是在哪一方面呢？
对，我觉得真的机遇很多很多但我真的要去想的话，可能我觉得可能最颠覆性的还是可能 AI 会带来的一些机会，而且我觉得可能 AI 会带来一些机会，可能我们今天可能都想象不出来。其实，往往最大的机会，他们都是比较颠覆性的，就是很多时候都是当时不存在的。就像很多人，比如说，我们有第一个汽车的时候，我们如果有之前问大家说，你们觉得未来的交通怎么样？大家可能说，哦，我可能有一匹马，我的马可能现在更壮一点，或者我可能有2匹马去帮我拉一个车，对不对？就是你很难去想象，比如说有些新的科技会怎么颠覆一个行业，所以我觉得我们现在想的可能是觉得像 AI 会帮忙，像银行的客服会提高他们的客服能力啊等等， 但我觉得 AI 今后可能对于这个行业还是会有一些特别颠覆、特别颠覆性的一些改变，而且会带来很多颠覆性的机会。
好，那就今天的问题就到此为止。那非常感谢 David 百忙之中抽空和我们分享你的经验，也是就分享你一些对于不同的领域或者不同前景的一些看法，非常感谢。
对。那我特别高兴有机会，我们可以一起聊一下，然后也多谢你给我这机会。
Yeah, thank you so much, David, for taking the time to share with us your experiences. Personally, I'm very inspired by, how your curiosity has taken you to so many different places and how these experiences added up. And also, as a founder myself, I'm very inspired by how you just, be willing to try and take new things so long as you see that there's an opportunity to do so. So thank you so much for joining us on today's episode, David.
Of course, thanks so much for inviting me. Also very inspired by your own journey and hope to keep in touch.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for listening to Business Beyond Borders. If you have any feedback or thoughts, do write in to us at support@bluen.com. Click to follow to tune into the next episode. See you again soon.